Welcome to our show. This is a conversation about a topic which, if you kind of have your ear to the ground about this kind of thing, maybe you think you know the story, and maybe you do know the story, of Patient HM, which is, in fact, the title of a new book by Luke Dietrich, Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. Particularly if you live here in Connecticut, there's a better chance you know this story because most of it, well, maybe not most of it, an awful lot of it takes place in Connecticut. HM, in fact, was the name of a man, the initials of a man, named Henry, who, in fact, was from kind of central Connecticut. His life trajectory took him to various places like Hartford and Manchester and Willimantic and Coventry, and a lot of familiar towns will come up as we discuss where he was, or if you read Luke Dietrich's book. It's the story of a man who became the most studied patient in the history of neuroscience. The reason that that happened was, in fact, a surgery performed on him to help him that instead incapacitated him. I shouldn't be telling this story. The guests should be telling the story. So let's switch over to that. Joining us by phone is, in fact, Luke Dietrich, a journalist and author of Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. In the studio with me is Dr. Hank Schwartz, a psychiatrist and chief vice president for behavioral health at the Institute of Living, Hartford Healthcare, and professor of psychiatry at UConn School of Medicine. Also with us, Dr. David Glahn, director of Affective Disorders and Psychosis Trials, Olin Neuropsychiatry Research Center at Hartford Healthcare, and associate professor of psychiatry at Yale. So we've got a lot of firepower here. Luke, since it's your book, I'm going to get you to lead off here. Tell us a little bit more about who HM is and why he became so important.
Sure. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me. I'll start, I guess, at the beginning, what I always consider to be sort of the beginning of the story of Patient HM, which begins back before he was Patient HM, when he was, just Henry Mollison. And to me and to a lot of people, I think that story begins one evening in the mid-1930s when he was about 8 years old, and he was walking home from a park that a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with
Cole Park
in downtown Hartford. And he was walking home from the playground, and it was July 3rd, I believe, and he stepped out into the street, and he was knocked down by a bicyclist. It sort of sent him flying, and he hit his head hard on the ground. It knocked him unconscious for about five minutes. He woke up. He had a gash in his head, but otherwise he seemed more or less okay. Pretty shortly thereafter, though, he began suffering from minor seizures, and eventually those seizures got progressively worse and worse until by his 16th birthday, he started having sort of major convulsive seizures, and by his early 20s, he was really severely incapacitated. He was having major seizures almost daily. It was a situation where, his high school principal wouldn't let him walk across the stage to get the diploma because he was afraid that Henry might have a seizure on stage and cause embarrassment to the whole group. And so it was very desperate. A very desperate situation for Henry and his family, and in their desperation, they were willing to try almost anything, and ultimately they turned to a local neurosurgeon, William Scoville, who was the founder and director of Hartford Hospital's Department of Neurosurgery. He was, quite sort of renowned in his field, by all accounts, a very skilled neurosurgeon. And Dr. Scoville offered Henry and his family hope in the form of a fairly radical experimental operation. And they chose to take that chance. And as it turned out, as you mentioned, the operation was not entirely successful in terms of curing Henry's epilepsy. What its sort of most significant after effect was that it caused Henry to sort of live the rest of his life with a profound amnesia. He sort of lived his life in more or less 30-second increments. The present would constantly slide off of him. And this was tragic for Henry, but it was ultimately sort of revelatory for the field of memory science. A lot of what we know about how memory works came from the sort of subsequent half century of experiments conducted with Henry.
First of all, a couple of quick things here. So, I mean, for people trying to get kind of a sense of this, and I have the disease of understanding things through popular culture, if you've seen the movie Memento, that probably was based partly on Henry. It's maybe gives you kind of a sense of what that sort of snapshot experience of life is like for someone in that position. And I guess the other thing that we should say, because, Luke, we are going to be kind of delving into some of the consequences of this for Henry. I mean, we're already alluding to them, that one thing that you do document in your book, although you're pretty tough on this surgeon Scoville, who turns out to be your grandfather, but that, you know, they had tried kind of the version of the 1953 version of everything, right? They hit him with Dilantin and any other drug that they had. It wasn't as though this was a frivolously not the last option choice, right? They kind of had done other things that were less invasive.
That's correct. The surgery took place in 1953, but Henry consulted with my grandfather, with Dr. Scoville, in the mid 1940s first, and for years they tried all sorts of anti-epileptic drugs, and they didn't really help, or they didn't help enough. It certainly was not the first recourse. It was after sort of all possibilities at the time had more or less been exhausted that they decided to take this fairly radical step.
So, Hank Schwartz, this is a time, I mean, it is important to put this stuff in the context of its time. This is a time where things are not as they are, were not as they are now. Less is known. Luke has a rather felicitous phrase in his book where it's something to the effect that it's the fate of the broken to illuminate the problems of the unbroken at times. And so you do have things being tried which are not tried now. Maybe you could kind of give us sort of a general overview of the state of treatment for both neurological and psychiatric disorders at this time.
Oh, sure. And certainly the state of treatment was nothing like the state of treatment is today. So really the best example, and the example I'm most familiar with, is the application of these kinds of surgeries to patients with specifically psychiatric issues, which came along right at around the same time. And I guess in the popular imagination, when we think about psychosurgery and lobotomy at those times, it stands out as a terrible thing that physicians were engaged in. But in fact, the options for treatment at that time were very few. In the early 50s, we were just seeing the very beginning of the introduction of pharmaceutical agents, medications that could control psychiatric symptoms, lithium and Thorazine being amongst the first. But this was coming along slowly. There was what Mr. Dietrich calls in the book electroshock therapy, which has turned out to be very effective as electroconvulsive therapy in today's terms, but at that time was performed without anesthesia and somewhat indiscriminately in the sense of kind of knowing what kind of disorders might respond to it. So he also
describes once again, this is also being performed at the Institute of Living, kind of therapy where the patient's temperature is raised to quite literally a fever pitch, where a fever of say 105 and 106 is repeatedly induced in a patient. What was the thinking there?
Well, the thinking there was let's try whatever we can try. It was noticed that patients put in cold wet packs, the opposite of raising the temperature, became calmer. People didn't know then what was at play. We now know that there's this kind of diving seal reflex that does actually calm people. There was thinking that perhaps there were unknown infectious agents that might be at play in some mental illnesses and that heat therapies might be effective. But in essence, they were not terribly effective, though some of the cold therapies were. So the options for many people were to spend a life within an institution. As psychosurgery was introduced, I think the intention clearly was to provide an option which would enable people to get out of institutional life. We know that depending on the psychosurgical procedure and when in the course of history and the refinement of these procedures, some people did very well, but others did very, very poorly.
Let me just press on that a little bit, because I get the feeling reading not only Luke's book, but some of the other literature around this, that, that psychosurgery was sometimes used for neurosis. You know, neurosis isn't something that would have required the kind of high-powered drugs that you're talking about that didn't exist then. Talk therapy was, not a new thing anymore. So, it does seem as though the pervasiveness of the use of psychosurgery, of lobotomies, if it's being used for neurosis, that doesn't even seem explicable by the state of biochemical science at that moment.
Well, I'd have to agree if you're thinking about neurosis in the way that we think about it today. In the 1950s, I guess the equivalent diagnosis might have been neurasthenia, which was a term applied generally to people with vague symptoms, but for some of whom were bad enough that they would wind up institutionalized for a long period of time. But there's no question that the procedures were, while effective for some people with very, very disabling disorders who had no other recourse, were applied indiscriminately with a kind of therapeutic zeal that far outstripped what the procedures had to offer. And we know of, any number of cases of folks, the Kennedy's daughter, for instance, or sister, who had, very, very poor outcomes. But at the same time, as our author, Luke Dietrich, reports in his book, other folks, for instance, his grandmother, who also underwent this procedure, appear to have done very well.
Okay, I want to get to the grandmother in just a second here. And as you know, Hank, I'm a basket of neuroses and neurasthenic symptoms. So I'm sensitive about this. These producers around here would give me a lobotomy if they got a chance. In a heartbeat, they would do this. So
We will stand between them and
right.
you.
I want this to be the radio equivalent of some kind of advanced directive. I don't want a lobotomy. So I want to come back to Luke's grandmother in just a second. But Dr. David Glahn, and I may have misstated your title, professor of psychiatry at Yale. I think it might be worth it just right now to look forward a little bit and just talk about if, in fact, HM is the most studied patient in the history of neuroscience because of this rather unique position in which he was rendered. What did we learn from? How many things do we know as a result of studying HM?
So HM, the surgical procedure that was conducted with HM involved a resection of the medial temporal lobe on both the left side and the right side, and it included removal of the hippocampus, the entorhinal cortex, and the amygdala, as well as portions of the parahippocampal gyrus. So what happened, as we've talked about here, is that when he awoke, he had a profound amnesia, an inability to learn new information. So what was a fundamental shift at that point was that particular brain regions could be engaged in this idea of learning and memory. Before, there was a distributed model. That is, the thought was that memory particularly was being housed in every portion of the brain, and what would be associated with memory loss was just a significant enough removal of brain, and that would be associated with memory. Instead, now after HM, and actually HM, I believe, was one of several surgeries that took the same kind of procedure, there was this notion that, here you have an individual who had a normal memory beforehand and suddenly became amnestic. So the initial questions had to do with how memory works, and particularly the episodic memory, the ability to remember things about yourself and episodes that you were in. And that went along for a long way because we were able to show that he can't learn new information, but old information was maintained.
Right. So we know from Luke's book, for example, that he could tell that story that Luke told about his diploma, about the fact that he wasn't allowed and why he wasn't allowed to get his diploma. And was it significant that I don't know how common this was, that he obviously was, you know, a very responsive conversationalist, a very cooperative person. Luke says, as patients go, he was very patient, that you had a person who had been in one way profoundly damaged, but also incredibly easy to get information out of respecting what information he actually had.
Absolutely. And that he was someone who even before his surgery, based on reports that I've read and from the book that we're discussing, you know, he was an amicable individual beforehand as well, right? He was somebody that went along. He's somebody that you know, seemed to be an easy to work with individual. What happened then was that we learned from the surgery, we learned that the hippocampus and these other brain regions seem to be very strongly involved in our ability to learn new information. So that was it. That was one major breakthrough. That was work that was done by a woman named Brenda Milner, who came to do some of the initial assessments of HM. Then subsequent to that, we began to piece apart aspects of, well, what is intact and what isn't intact with HM, and that's really what took the majority of the next 40 years or 50 years of work with him, of trying to understand what things changed and what didn't. For example, later experiments focused very much on learning procedural activities, so learning to write backwards or to write on a maze, or based on seeing a mirror. And it was discovered that he could perform that as well as healthy subjects over time. So there is a type of learning there. Think about it as in the type of learning of playing a piano piece, right? So there's a piece where you're trying to learn it based on seeing the parts, but then there's a part in which it becomes the motor movement component of it. Mm-hmm. And so what was intact was his ability to do that. And that was another earth-shattering kind of moment in cognitive neuroscience, because it taught us that all memory is not the same, that there are differences within brain of how that type of memory works. And so that's another kind of thing that was very important. What's happened after that, though, is that there's been a lot of work that's done post, in addition to the work with HM. And that has helped us kind of understand the different brain regions involved and how they worked. The resection that happened with HM I mentioned previously included a number of different brain regions. In subsequent cases, it was either rarely due to surgical resection, but often due to other types of lesions or hypoxia that other brain regions might be disrupted, and we were able to get a much better feel for, well, which region really is it? Is it really the hippocampus that's the primary effect, or is it the parahippocampal gyrus? And that type of work continues to this day, but the profound effects on HM immediately stopped that type of bilateral resection.
All right. Well, I'm going to just stop you there. And I want to say, first of all, that Luke's book reads very much like an account of the history of one moment in medical science, but also very much like a literary memoir. And it's very much about real people. Scientists are people. They're human beings. Doctors and surgeons are human beings. They have human qualities. They're not machines. They're not robots. And this comes very much through, Luke, in your book. So, you know, and a lot of us have, in fact, heard other stories about Wild Bill Scoville, the guy who performed this this radical lobotomy that changed HM's life. And, you know, he has kind of reputation. You document that as kind of a man of action, a man who maybe even seeks out action and thrills, a guy who might arrive in the emergency room or of the hospital, of the neurology ward, and say that he'd been chased by the police for speeding and he thought he'd eluded them, but that he wanted the nurses to say that he was now in surgery performing a radical craniotomy or something. That this is a guy who, you know, there's a little bit of a ready, fire, aim quality to him. And I think that's sort of part of his legend. The part of his legend that I had never heard before is the story of your grandmother, who, in fact, was a psychiatric patient at the Institute of Living and kind of, you know, starting in the 1940s. Parallel to this whole story is the story of Bill Scoville dealing with the deterioration and attempt to treat a woman he apparently profoundly loved and cared about and wanted to help. And so how did that inform in your understanding his thinking about his role as a doctor treating neurological patients as opposed to psychiatric patients?
Right. It was a huge moment in my reporting, I think, was when I kind of got access to some of the documents related to my grandmother's institutionalization, and sort of I learned for the first time really sort of the details of her mental illness and a lot of the details of her treatment. And then also, I mean, I think one of the things that I certainly didn't understand coming into the beginning of stages of writing the book, I did not understand the sort of connections between my grandmother's mental illness and my grandfather's ultimate, you know, very kind of fervent passion for psychosurgery. I mean, he was one of the most prolific lobotomists ever, and a very sort of active proselytizer for the procedure. And I think, it's very difficult to sort of you know, assign motives to people. But he at least in one letter to one of his sons, did say that, you know, the reason that he was so active in psychosurgery and in trying to come up with a surgical, you know, fix for mental illness was all for E's sake, E being Emily, my grandmother. And so that gave his, you know, it's both poignant and troubling to me to think about this sort of personal quest that he was on. And also, you know, in this strange way, then it's really impossible to understand the operation that he performed on Henry, although Henry's operation was not strictly speaking a psychosurgical procedure because he was epileptic. He didn't suffer from mental illness. It still grew out of a series of experimental psychosurgical procedures, and it was in fact identical to procedures that he had previously performed in asylums. And so there was this odd connection between, again, sort of my grandmother's mental illness being in some ways this sort of precipitating factor that, you know, ultimately led to this decision to perform this radical experimental operation on Henry, which ultimately sort of revolutionized memory science. And I think that connection between psychosurgery and Henry's operation is one that, you know, hasn't been explored that much. And this also, I mean, as Dr. Schwartz was saying, there was this sort of, you know, there were certainly this sort of therapeutic motivations behind psychosurgery, but there were also sort of experimental ones. I mean, I think there was an aspect of kind of experimentalist zeal that was at play during the heyday of psychosurgery that also hasn't been all that well explored, I found. I mean, I think one of the more shocking quotes that I uncovered in the course of my research was from another neurosurgeon, a man named Paul Busey, who operated out of University of Chicago, who was in correspondence with John Fulton, who was the head of the Department of Physiology at Yale University, and was in some ways sort of the godfather of the intellectual godfather of the lobotomy, you could say. He wrote him a letter after he'd begun performing lobotomies, and he said, he said, "Man is certainly no poorer as an experimental animal merely because he can talk." And this was it was an era in which all of a sudden operations that had once been limited to animals could now be, there was sort of a therapeutic rationale for performing them on humans, and you could then, you know, by extension, sort of, you know, see what happened. And that led to, you know, it certainly in Henry's case, that led to, a revolution in memory science, but at a great human cost, which...
Yeah. I just, yeah. Before we go to a break, I want to ask Hank about this. So there are scenes in Luke's book from the, you know, from the this distant a past, and maybe even a past a little bit before the Scoville surgery on HM, where you see these things which, to my 2016 sensibilities, are kind of alarming. You see these patients having these surgeries when they're under locals, and where on one occasion we see a neurosurgeon performing a surgery where he basically says that he's going to keep moving the instrument until he sees the patient's brain disrupted, and that, in fact, certain flattenings in her affect and things like that are encouraging to him because it means he's essentially scrambling things that need to be scrambled or changing the brain in a way that it needs to be changed, and he's just sort of listening in real time. There's also a similar scene with somebody who has Tourette syndrome where the instrument just keeps moving until this patient stops saying, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch. I'm assuming the protocols are different now and that you just couldn't get that kind of surgery done half as therapy and half as an experiment, it seems. It just doesn't get off the launch pad anymore.
Yeah. I think the operative phrase there was your 2016 sensibilities, mm-hmm. Because certainly these kinds of things could not happen by today's standards. I mean, at the time, therapeutic zeal and research were ambiguously joined, and controls over research, you know, really came much later. It wasn't until 1947 that the Nuremberg Code was issued as a result of the Nuremberg trials and learning about Nazi research on human subjects. And it wasn't, until the 1960s that our, you know, kind of current concepts of informed consent for research led to the development of institutional review boards, for instance, and strict federal regulations, and a major shift in our thinking about what kind of behaviors on the part of surgeons and physicians was acceptable, and sharp distinctions between the research world and treatment.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking with three different guests about one book, Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets by Luke Dietrich. I do want to quickly say before we go to break, it's amazing reading this book like here because, I mean, I'm sitting right now just a few miles from where the surgery was performed, from where the institute is. I bike past Luke's grandmother's house on North Steel Road all the time. It's a very profoundly – and, of course, HM himself is just – was all over Connecticut in the course of his life. So it's an amazing book to read sitting right here. We'll take a little break and we'll come back. And we're back. We're here with Luke Dietrich is joining us by phone, journalist and the author of Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. Also in studio with me is Dr. Harold Hank Schwartz, psychiatrist in chief, VP for Behavioral Health, the Institute of Living, and professor of psychiatry at UConn School of Medicine. Dr. David Glahn, director of affective disorders and psychosis trials at Olin Neuropsychiatry Research Center, Hartford Healthcare, and professor of psychiatry at Yale. Dr. David Glahn, it's you know, to read this book, and once again, as Hank says and as I say, with my 2016 sensibilities, I find myself occasionally getting frustrated, maybe even angry at Luke's grandfather. And I don't know, maybe it's important to just talk about the fact that some of these people doing these surgeries that do seem glaringly out of sync with our value system right now, by and large, and I think this is a point that Luke makes, they weren't evil, mad scientists, bad guys. They were people who really were very, very focused on the idea of healing people. I don't know. I find that so hard to reconcile with some of the things that I find them doing now.
So I would agree. And there's pretty much no way you can't agree with that kind of statement because you're looking at the difficulty of first do no harm, but comparing that to the question of I have to do something. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's part of where the zeal comes from. That notion that it's very easy for us to say, we had other alternate routes or there are other treatments that were available. But at the time, you had people that were basically put into into a treatment facility and never had any possible option for going anywhere else. And the level of treatment that we could have for them was so small. So I understand that zeal at the level of really a true desire to do good for the patients that were there. Certainly there is the potential that the zeal for this clinical work could go well beyond what we today would think would be wise, and possibly even beyond what at the time some people were thinking was the right thing to do. But you know, we're now looking back at it and trying to understand not simply what they learned, but also different ways that we could move forward. I mean, one of the things that is kind of interesting here is that the removal of portions of brain is still one of our primary and or at least last resort treatments of epilepsy. And particularly now we know you only do it on one side. There's only unilateral surgical procedures. And we spend a lot of time trying to find where's the seat of the seizure and then remove that brain. Part of that comes from the experiences of Henry and his surgery and what happened to him afterwards, that we realize that you can't do a bilateral surgery of this kind in this area. And so even today, there are still clinical implications, not simply our understanding of memory, but clinical implications of the kind of work that was going on then, even if it to our current sensibilities seems to be so difficult for us to understand.
You know, there's something I want all three of you to talk about, but Luke, I'm going to start with you. So there's all the conversation that we're just having about everything that led up to the radical lobotomy surgery performed on HM. But then there's his status as a patient afterwards, which is a fascinating thing too. Here's this guy who is this treasure trove of potential avenues of research, and he's not just potential, it's a realized potential in many cases. But now what you've got is a patient who is conscious, who is volitional in a lot of ways, who's able to talk about himself and act on his own behalf in certain ways. But you start wondering about the question of informed consent now, too. I mean, there's a question of informed consent before surgery. Now there's a question of informed consent afterwards. This is a guy who's essentially going to agree to be studied for decades and decades and decades. I don't know. What did you conclude ultimately about this part of the story?
Right. So I do think that informed consent is one of these themes that plays out throughout the story. I'd actually argue that there isn't really a serious question of informed consent when it comes to Henry's operation itself. Mm-hmm. Although I would slightly take issue with the idea that it was only after Henry's surgery that epilepsy surgeons knew not to go bilaterally. I'd say that, you know, the chief epilepsy surgeon at the time worldwide really was a guy named Wilder Penfield at the Montreal Neurological Institute, and he would never perform his operations bilaterally. He sort of plays a part in the book. My grandfather's decision to actually go bilaterally in Henry's case was, I think, certainly in even by the standards of the time, by the standards of 1953, was a questionable one. But in terms of informed consent, Henry was, you know, in desperate straits. He was an adult, and he chose to have that operation, and he certainly understood that there were some risks, even though those risks were not, you know, foreseen ultimately by anybody. I would say that in the cases of a lot of the psychosurgeries that led up to Henry's operation, there were real sort of egregious and profound violations of informed consent. Although, as Dr. Schwartz pointed out, informed consent was sort of a work in progress at the time. Although, again, you know, Nuremberg Code 1947, a lot of these things happened after 1947. Our modern concept of informed consent doesn't differ too much from the first point of the Nuremberg Code. But in terms of Henry's experience as a research subject post-operatively, in my research, I think that there definitely are serious questions to be raised about whether informed consent was adhered to in his case, because certainly during the last decades of his life, it was not only this sort of concept from the Nuremberg Code, but it was sort of legally enshrined, and there were rules and regulations, and it does seem like, though in some cases those were skirted. There was a period of 12 years, for example, between 1980 and 1992, when Henry was the only person signing his informed consent forms for the research that was conducted with him. As Dr. Glahn pointed out, the surgery removed not just his hippocampus, but also his amygdala. And one of the effects of sort of amygdala ablation is to render a person sort of more passive, more docile, more tractable. And so you become then sort of neurologically predisposed to consent to almost anything when you don't have an amygdala. You combine that with this sort of profound amnesia that really, it's going to be hard for him to even remember the end of a form by the time he gets to it. And you really have a patient that it's hard to argue is capable of consenting on his own. After that, he received a conservator, a court-appointed conservator, who had claimed to be Henry's closest living relative. It turns out he was not. Henry's closest living relatives were never consulted. And there, I could go on. There were a lot of issues related to informed consent in Henry's case.
All right. Well, before we run out of time here, and there's some other things we want to talk about, I want to give everybody else a chance to talk a little bit about this. So, Hank Schwartz, this is a complicated area, right? I mean, you've got somebody who you're studying him because of, what we would crudely maybe call a mental defect. So then there are questions about whether he can participate in informed consent about his own handling.
I think on the face of it, somebody who can't remember anything, any new information beyond 30 to 60 seconds or so, cannot give informed consent by today's standards of judging informed consent, no question. And for years, as Luke Dietrich points out, he was signing his own consent. When a conservator ultimately was appointed, it was kind of under questionable circumstances. So I think that is clearly an ongoing issue in this story. Another element of the informed consent is the concept of the balance of risks and benefits. That did change how we would interpret risks and benefits and how whether the patient was to determine them on the basis of his own background and feelings or on the basis of the amount of information that a reasonable doctor would provide. That all settled out through the 50s, 60s, and 70s in a series of court cases which have led to a current regulatorily driven rules and regulations about informed consent that didn't exist in 1953. However, there were clearly surgeons at the time who, without regulations telling them that the risks of surgery have to be outweighed clearly by its benefits, believed that. And these were people who would not engage in psychosurgery and were opposed to it. So there, there clearly was, getting back to the Wild Bill concept, there were notions of individual values and personality factors at play in the provision of these kinds of procedures that were, very, very variable according to the doctor and the doctor's choice at a time when regulation was really just growing.
We're going to take a quick break. We have one more set of issues we want to get into here. So we'll take that break. We'll come back and finish up the show.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kion Wolf, with help from Patrick Scahill. All of our shows are available on WNPR.org/Colin, on our Facebook page, and on Stitcher, iTunes, and TuneIn. On tomorrow's show, the circus, not this political season. And now... Back to Colin.
So we're talking today about the story of Patient HM, which is also the title of Luke Dietrich's new book. It's subtitled A Story of Memory Madness and Family Secrets. The family secrets have to do with the fact that the man who performed the surgery on HM that created the impaired memory forming condition, which then told the rest of the story of HM's life, the man who did that surgery is Luke's grandfather. Also, very poignant story of Luke's grandmother as well. In studio with me is Dr. Harold Hank Schwartz, psychiatrist in chief and vice president for behavioral health at the Institute of Living, professor of psychiatry at UConn School of Medicine, and Dr. David Glahn. You have long titles. I'm going to skip over some of them. Professor of psychiatry at Yale. So, Luke Dietrich, when you have a book out, this is an immensely readable book, and I've been fascinated by it. And there are a lot of local tie-ins, as I was saying. And in fact, both your grandmother and Suzanne Corkin, the person we're going to talk about next, went to Oxford School. I went to Kingswood School. They were sister and brother schools. They're merged together now. But your book is creating some news here, too. And it's news that it's always good for an author if there's news. But there's news in the form of pushback, too, particularly as regards your depiction of Suzanne Corkin, one of the researchers who worked with HM, taking over from Brenda Milner at MIT. David Glahn talked about her earlier. And so there have been some claims that among other things, that you talk about the possibility or the probability that she destroyed before her death some raw data relating to HM. There are some other things in the book about kind of a spat or a dispute about ownership of the brain tissue of HM. But can you just talk a little bit about the kind of pushback you've been getting lately? There are some other researchers and scientists who are upset about this part of the book.
Sure. Yeah. No, I started getting pushback. The book was excerpted in the New York Times Magazine a week before the book itself came out. And there was a letter signed by 200 neuroscientists that came out a couple days after the book excerpt was published, basically pushing back at my depiction of Suzanne Corkin. I can't say I'm, you know, entirely surprised that it would receive pushback. It isn't the depiction of, I think, the story of Patient HM that people are used to reading. And I think that there are troubling aspects to the story and troubling aspects to the way that the research was conducted that were brought up in the book that certainly, you know, ruffled feathers in the neuroscience community. I will say, though, that, you know, everything that's been sort of controversial, you mentioned, for example, the question of whether raw data was shredded by Suzanne Corkin, you know, that is something that comes directly from my interview with Suzanne Corkin. I mean, it's her words that I'm using, and those I even, you know, in response to the pushback, I put an audio recording of that portion of my interview with her online.
In fact, Luke, we have a little bit of that audio. We're just going to play it right now.
Well, the tests are gone. The test data, the data sheets are gone because the stuff is published.
Uh-huh.
Most of it is published, or a lot of it is published.
But not all of it. And also, I find that pretty surprising.
Well, the things that aren't published are, you know, experiments that just didn't go right. Or didn't, you know, there was a problem with him, like he had a seizure or something like that, or...
But, you know, even what's published, I mean, as you know, I mean, you look at the papers, and the papers, in some sense, are the tip of each paper is kind of, you know, the tip of this iceberg of the work that was done, and the work that was done, you know, all that data floating around underneath. It seems to me that so much of that would be valuable to preserve, that people really may well want to go back and review. And
there's no place to preserve it.
There's no place to preserve it? Not at MIT or... How many files are we talking here? I mean, are we talking about, you know, a storeroom like this full of boxes of papers, or?
No, not that much.
No. But they're mostly at your home now?
Some of it was. No, not now. Okay. It isn't, no.
It's just in storage somewhere, or?
Most of it has gone, in the trash, was shredded.
Most of it was already shredded?
Yeah.
Yeah, just recently, or?
Yeah, when I moved.
When you moved, you shredded it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And so what's, and what is left, most of it, you're planning to shred?
Probably.
Dr. David Glahn, I've been having an emailing back and forth with a neuroscientist that I know and respect who I think is probably on the side of the people who are raising some questions about this part of Luke's book. On the other hand, this is kind of I don't know. I'm just not familiar with what's being described here. I mean, how out of the ordinary does it sound to you?
It depends a little bit on exactly what kind of information you're talking about. If you're talking about the shredding of notes that were taken at a certain point when you were working on an experiment that were just sort of a rough notes kind of thing, it's common for that type of information to not be maintained. If what you're talking about is actually data, so information that's specifically about the information about the subject or their performance or something along those lines, that it's very rare to actually have that shredded or to remove that. Currently most information has a shelf life, right? So if we do an experiment at this time, there's a certain period of time that we maintain that information because that's what the institutional review board specifies, and then after that time, it is often destroyed. But HM is a very special case, right? Most of the people that are coming through are fairly typical. And may not be the kinds of people that we want to keep and archive forever. I will point out that in a letter written by Dr. Corkin's chairman, that he specified that actually none of the information was actually shredded, and that he doesn't really understand why she answered that way in the interview. I don't know the validity of one of those cases versus the other, because obviously it's not primary source for me, right? I'm mm-hmm. hearing it just the way that you are, but I would be surprised, given that Dr. Corkin had really spent her entire academic life working on this and working with HM in order to produce the kinds of information that we as a scientific community were looking for. So there's something going on here. Exactly where it is unclear to me what's happening, but it certainly would be unusual.
Once again, this is like a four-hour conversation. We've got 2 minutes left, Hank, so I apologize for putting you in that state. But I would assume the scientific community is going to want to investigate this a little bit more. My antennae, which are very uneducated antennae, go up when I hear her say, well, there were some experiments that didn't go right. In general, we want to know about those experiments too.
Well, sure. By they didn't go right, does that mean that the experiments did not actually prove the hypothesis, or did that mean that they were just interrupted by an epileptic seizure or whatever? We certainly would want to know that. I am not the scientist that Dr. Glahn is, so I almost have a lay medical view of this. But if it is true that that basic data was destroyed, I would find that kind of shocking behavior. There was a time 25 years ago when I did some research, and I still have that basic data in my file tucked away in a rarely used bathroom at the Institute of Living.
Yeah, the stuff about me, by the way, you can now shred. all right, we have to stop here. This is I'm sorry, because this is a long conversation even about this part of the book, and there's just acres of this book that we're not talking about. So read the book. It's really interesting. Thanks so much to Luke Dietrich, author of Patient HM, Memory Madness and Family Secrets. And thanks so much to Dr. David Glahn, professor of psychiatry at Yale, and Dr. Harold Hank Schwartz, psychiatrist in chief at the Institute of Living. They have much longer titles, but then we'll be completely out of time if I give them all. Of course, it is great to have a producer who is a nurse, and I do, Betsy Kaplan. So, Betsy Kaplan, thanks for all the hard work and research and making me sound at least a tiny bit smarter than I actually am.
What the heck are we doing with the rest of it? Well, you got a brain to use it. You don't want to refuse it. It's a better for yourself.
the problem.